So our last speaker for these introductory remarks is Professor Green.
Well, I did take Tony seriously in saying, why don't you use PowerPoint? So I do have some PowerPoint slides. And in listening to previous speakers, all sorts of things came into my mind that I would love to talk about, but mindful of Nigel's admonition to stay on message, it's probably a good thing I have these PowerPoint slides. What I want to do, though, is I have some parables, and I have some pictures, and I'd like you to know that all the lettering on my slides is horizontal, and I have no graphs, but I do have some stories to tell. And what I wanted to do, I like this image of reframing. So I'm going to frame things very clearly, and what I want to frame things in a very direct and simple sort of a way. And along the way, I'll tell you how I gained some small measure of at least knowledge, if I don't think expertise, in this policy science business. First of all, what about science? In basic question, in this context, science asks questions like these, like what's going on, what do you do, how do you do it, those sorts of questions, the understanding questions. And that's those are in answers and information that we need in order to understand the world that we live in and the consequences of actions that happen in the world. We need to know this stuff. And scientists are the people who are in the knowledge business and can deliver these things, or we hope so. Then there's the policy guys. And the policy guys are, as Norm says, involved in will to act. It's all about the will to act. They are asking questions, why do we care about these issues? They're addressing, do we want to fix it? Is it fixable? But first you ask the policy question, do you want to fix it? Before you ask the practical question, how do you fix it? And finally, are we willing to pay for it? Or am I willing, as a policy guy, to get somebody else to pay for it? These are policy questions. This is this realm we're talking about. And the context of these two different sets of questions, very different. And the way in which they're judged is also very, very different. And I'm going to tell you my story, the first story, which goes back about 10 years or more. As Tony said, I was chair of the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada. I'll explain that a bit in a bit. I have a slide coming up. But I got on this committee because I study frogs. It's the committee that assesses the endangerment status of species in Canada, and they needed a frog guy. Who else is going to sit there and speak up for frogs and salamanders? That was me, see? So now, somebody who works on frogs and not methane knows for certain that not everybody's going to care. So it breeds humility right there. Now, at the time, about 12 years ago, the Liberal government was attempting to get through Parliament the Species at Risk Act. And it had gone through many iterations. This is like a third try, plus a private member's bill. And the minister of the time, David Anderson, who's here looking worried, was charged with bringing this bill in. Maybe you remember this. Maybe you're too young. Maybe you remember. And there was opposition. It was one of these, I suppose, type 3 kind of cases. Nobody really understands what makes species go endangered. Nobody really understands what to do about it. And the will to do something about it was all over the map. There were people who wanted to act strongly now and protect the birds, and other people who would hope it would all go away. And we have conflicts between the bunny huggers and the bunny killers. It was all over the map. So at this point, the Minister of the Environment had to ask himself, and observing what's going on, because I had a chance to talk with him on a number of occasions, which is very interesting. You have to ask, who was he doing this for? Who was the bill for? Not for endangered species. Where was the capital? political capital to be gained by passing this law. What was the government going to gain for it? And more precisely, what was government policy on endangered species laws to begin with? And if you don't get these right, then you don't understand the game. And for a long time, I don't think we really understood what these answers were. I can tell you now, who was the minister doing it for? He was doing it for the government. He was doing it for himself so he wouldn't be, you know, turfed out of his corner office. What precisely was the political capital to be gained? None. At this time, the government was not going to win anything. It could only lose if it didn't pass it because it would look weak. And what was government policy there for? Government policy was to pass the law and get it over with. This is the end game. However noble it started with, this was the end game of the passage of this law. So who's involved in this? This is policymaking at the very highest level. This is where laws get done. Laws get done in Parliament in this country. So who's he up against, the minister trying to bring this in? Prime Minister, tell him, better do it. In the Cabinet, he has to have Cabinet solidarity behind it. He has to have the government caucus in favor of it, so they'll vote for it. He has to have the provinces and territories online. He has to deal with landowners and industry, the whole business. Who are his friends? Nobody. Who are the people he can not afford to piss off? Well, all those people who would vote for him or vote for his party and keep his job. Who are the people he can afford to piss off? The people who don't have clout. He can afford to piss off the opposition. That's what they're there for. He can afford to piss off the conservation non-government organizations because he can always say to them, here's your law, you want the law? What are you arguing with me about? And he can afford to ignore scientists because scientists don't have political clout and didn't at that time. Why? Here's the story. During this debate, there were two lobbies, among many lobbyists, who were trying to promote their point of view. And I, as the chair of Kasiwik, was trying to navigate through, I had to remain aloof from the lobbyists because I was involved in it. Kasiwik was an extremely important part of the law, as it is today, and assessment is a very important procedure that has to be done. So I had a chance to observe, but I was talked at by many of these folks. One group was Scientists for Species, and another group was called SARWIG, which is an unfortunate acronym. But Scientists for Species were a group of many scientists from all over North America. It's organized by Stuart Elge. He was a very clever guy, and kind of politically savvy, a little bit politically cynical, too. The Species at Risk Working Group, SARWIG, was all these agencies. You know, there's Nature Federation, the Pulp and Paper Association, the Wildlife Federation, the Mining Association, and the Sierra Club, both industry and conservation groups. And part of this mix was Elizabeth May. We know about Elizabeth May now. Maybe this is how she really got the taste for politics. Scientists for Species had a logo. SARWIG did not. Scientists for Species had 1,331 scientists representing themselves. They had signed a letter. And really, the Mexicans and Americans don't count because they don't vote in the United States, in Canada. And they had a letter campaign, very uncompromising sorts of language. SARWIG represented more than 1 million people, 1 million jobs, over $100 billion in investments and revenues. They offered detailed briefs. They gave pragmatic amendments. They did their homework, and they lobbied hard. Who had clout? Well, it's easy. SARWIG had clout. In fact, SARWIG morphed into a permanent body that's advisory to government. And Scientists for Species, they still have a logo. Now, why is it? I mean, all for our best intentions. Why does a scientist have so little clout? For one thing, and as we've heard how easy it is, the scientists at the time overestimated their influence. You figure, oh, we're scientists. You should listen to us. But No, they didn't understand how to measure political influence. They spoke for themselves. They didn't have the votes. And they failed to understand that once, very important principle, once you enter into the policy discussion business, you're just another opinion. And you can be challenged by all the other opinions. So, well, what makes you so special? I've got these facts. I don't believe you. And it's the belief and perceptions that really do matter in this other world that's outside of our training as scientists. It's a strange and scary place. So here's Kasiewicz, and this is this committee that I chaired. It has a logo too, actually. Kasiewicz is an important kind of an example of how to bridge this gap. Because what Kasiewicz does, scientists are on Kasiewicz. This is the process that it inveigles. And you can all look at it and ignore me talking. I know you will. But it has this complicated procedure that's aimed at assessing the status of species in Canada and then communicating that to policymakers. So up the top there is the science bit. But the major function of Kasiewicz is that it's a translator of that scientific assessment into something that is understandable in the policy realm. It translates a whole lot of science into just a few words. It's endangered, or it's threatened, or it's a special concern, or we just don't know enough about it, and presents that to policymakers. And the reason why it's effective, and this I don't think is thoroughly appreciated, because there are lots of critics of Kasiewicz who would like to see assessment in the IUCN method of assessment too, reduced to formula. You know, put it in a computer, turn the crank, add some fuzzy numbers, you get an answer, and that should be it. But you can't sell that in the policy realm. Why Kasiewicz works is that there are 60 people around the table who argue about it, talk about it, and come to consensus and agree about it. And that answer comes from Kasiewicz, has that backing of those 60 people. It's not just one person. It's not just an answer from a black box. It got consensus. And there's even greater consensus because all those reports are read by provincial and federal government departments, and they agree on it. So that's the clout that it has. Extremely important. So, in other words, Kasiewicz is a translation device. It takes these ideas that are scientific and evaluate it in terms of probability. You ask, what's the probability of a species going extinct? And turns it into something that is backed up by weight of opinion, that is understood by the other side. So, there are books and there are many papers about how to talk to power and how to be listened to. This is a very interesting paper by Watson in 2005 with some advice for science advisors. You know, it's going to be demand-driven, be transparent, legitimate, sound, et cetera, identify the uncertainties. And in fact, 12 years ago, the government of the day put out this report, the SAGE report, Science Advice for Government Effectiveness, which advocates some very clear sort of guidelines for the kind of science that government should listen to or be able to assimilate, and government responsiveness to that advice, including, I might add, number 5, openness, which seems to have gone astray 12 years hence in federal government circles. But then on the other side of the divide are the policymakers and politicians. So here's someone who will remain anonymous for at least for a minute, because I was at a meeting a year ago, and on a panel like this, and one of the other panel members, a former politician, said the policy, said this with a straight face, should be evidence-informed, but not evidence-based. And that's sort of, and you think about what? This is a license to cherry pick. After talking, you know, we shouldn't cherry pick advice. This is a license for policymakers to choose what they want from out of this advice. And use it. Why are they doing that? Because they have their other agendas, and they're not necessarily feel themselves bound by science, but there are all the other contingent factors that are influencing what they have to say. I shouldn't tell you who it is, but I will. It's Philip Couillard, who is a former minister and high-ranking guy in the Quebec Liberal government, and a doctor, too. So what we like to think, and this is my last little series of pictures, and I had a chance to think about this lately. How on it is, I don't know. But we like to think as scientists that we have this nice two-way street with policymakers and government, particularly high levels, that, you know, government has science policy that it promulgates, which affects science, and then science gives advice back, you know, and government will listen to us, and that will guide policy, and around it goes. In fact, it's not like that. It's more of a We like to think that it's a therefore some kind of a consumer sort of economy, that government spends money, they buy this knowledge from us, and the spin-off helps industry. Isn't that nice? I know it's wrong, because really what we have, I think, is much more like a command economy in terms of science policy ads with you know, strategic grants and vetting of science initiatives. Government asks particular questions and wants particular answers, commands answers to particular questions. I'm going to give you money because I want you to tell us this. And the advice level from scientists is actually rather small for two reasons. Is not so much they're not interested, but scientists don't understand what to say. And politicians and policymakers don't really understand what scientists are saying to begin with. Really, where knowledge goes then is into industry, into the market, into consumers. And advice comes from there. That's what sets policy, much more than from science. Wouldn't it be nice if we could, you know, maybe we could move to a market economy? That should have resonance with the current government and federal government. But I don't know if we'll be able to change the terminology so quickly. So that's all I have to say. I hope I didn't go over time. Thanks.